The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Erica Stallings is titled, If You're a Young Black Woman in Corporate America, You're More Likely to Be Underpaid and Stressed. It was an enviable dilemma. Two galas on the same night. Luckily, they were at the same place, Manhattan's gleaming, glass-paneled Time Warner Center. First stop, the fourth floor for a party raising money for school reading programs. Tickets cost $1,000 a head for a cocktail reception in a lounge with sweeping views of Central Park. I wore a one-shoulder black Tahari dress and strappy Stuart Weitzman heels. On arrival, I was greeted by an acquaintance known to make five-figure gifts to the organization. After some small talk about summer plans, mine, a rental house with friends in Montauk, the Long Island fishing village that's become more swanky than shanty, Malia Obama celebrated her 19th birthday there a couple of summers ago, I tucked my Ferragamo clutch under my arm and rode the elevator up to the second event. Also $1,000 a ticket, this one supported a charter school network. More canapes, more champagne, more celebrities. Hi, Katie Couric. Although I was one of very few black faces in the crowd, I was pretty sure my polished appearance, my degrees from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Georgetown Law, and my career as an attorney signified that I was just like everyone else. I dressed the part, I talked the part. With my Narciso Rodriguez perfume, I even smelled the part. But here was the reality. A mentor had covered the price of my admission to both events. I attended UNC on a scholarship that included a stipend for living expenses. To complete my Juris Doctorate, I borrowed $100,000. The designer perfume, which has become my signature scent, was a gift from a friend who works in fashion. Those $250 Stuart Weitzman heels, I'd frantically charged them a decade earlier after a corporate head of diversity pulled me aside at a networking event to warn them my $80 flats would be held against me. And the whole time I was chatting about Montauk, I was fretting about my budget, specifically the $400 I'd just promised to lend a relative in need. Even though I make six figures and have a plum job in the Big Apple, I am like many black women in the sense that my family wasn't able to launch me financially into the world. It's simply not in our experience. In so many cases, we've had to work harder to get where we are. Once we get here, we have to work harder to stay. There's a lot riding on our success. People are counting on us. And so we live with the unsettling sense that with the slightest tug, our carefully conceived plans for success could instantly unravel. I'm 33 years old. No matter how much I achieve, it never feels like enough. And in many ways, it isn't enough. To pay off my student debt, buy a home, amass the kind of retirement funds I should have by now. Yet in the eyes of my rural North Carolina family, I have achieved the American dream. Anne Price has heard countless stories like mine from professional black women who are exhausted from sprinting just to stay in the middle of the pack. A policy analyst who spent the past 8 years as head of the Closing the Racial Wealth Gap initiative at the Insight Center for Community Economic Development in Oakland, Price says, I'm listening and nodding my head because what you're describing, first-generation college student, professionally successful, still struggling to keep yourself and your family afloat, is so common. It really speaks to the issue of why race, and not just class, is so important to understanding financial stability and well-being. Price, now also president of the Insight Center, points out that more and more black women are pursuing college degrees. The most important move we can make to secure a place in the middle class, or so we're told. 26% have earned a bachelor's degree or higher, up from 20% a decade ago. Yet we're running into two major roadblocks, says Price. The first is that it's really hard to build wealth when you don't have it passed down to you. Among college-educated black families, the average amount of inheritance, including cash, home, and other assets, is under $40,000, compared with over $150,000 for college-educated white families, according to a 2018 study in the American Journal of Economics and Sociology. About 87% of those black families receive less than $10,000 as opposed to about 59% of the white families. The second roadblock, says Price, is that black women are more likely to find themselves taking care of family members financially. This strips away about 27% of a black family's wealth, she notes. It also forces some hard accounting. The choice is, what do? Pay off my student loan? Start to save for retirement? Put away money for my child's education? I can't do all three and take care of parents or siblings. My white professional peers don't really get this. When I recently mentioned to one of them that I was considering taking on a second job as an adjunct professor to pay for my eventual wedding, she chided me for doomsday thinking. Easy for her to say when her parents had come up with $50,000 for her nuptials. Many of my white classmates have already paid off their student loans, if they had any, and are starting to purchase homes. A white friend from law school recently lamented her inability to find a satisfactory New York City apartment in her budget, which is $1 million. Even white people of more modest means might have parents who could take out a loan for a wedding or help with the down payment on a house, or at least serve as a guarantor for an apartment. It's disheartening to know your family can't, as my friend Maya, a black media professional in Washington, D.C., could tell you. We're super smart and accomplished and have degrees, and yet we're still doggy paddling, she says. Sometimes I go to Facebook and look at the profiles of white people from my high school, and they're visibly rolling in dough. We're doing good things, it's just that the gulf between them and me is so striking. I was raised by a single mother who worked full-time as a secretary and never made more than $25,000 a year. A heart attack had forced my grandmother to retire from nursing before she turned 40, but somehow, through a combination of loans, credit cards, and putting in extra hours, she and my mother managed to cover our bills. When I received my first law firm bonus back in 2012, $10,000 before taxes, a dizzying amount to me then, I had already earmarked a portion for my mom to help her make a down payment on a new car. I now keep a separate savings account for unexpected family expenses and regularly send money home. Although at 54, my mom is relatively young and putting aside money for her retirement, I'm already worrying that I'll need to find extra funds to cover shortfalls. I'm right to be concerned. Married black women age 60 and older with a bachelor's degree have only $424,000 in median wealth, all assets including cash but minus debts. Their white counterparts have $778,000, according to researchers from Duke University and the Insight Center. Sending money to our parents is something 45% of college-educated black households do, says a 2017 study in the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis Review. Only 16% of college-educated white households do the same. Take Hannah, whose story will sound familiar to many black women my age. Hannah always knew her family was working class. Her parents had immigrated to the U.S. from Ethiopia and were raising four children primarily on her father's salary. She was accepted to several prestigious universities. She decided on Dartmouth because of its generous financial aid package. At school, she juggled work-study jobs at a call center, the library, and an administrative office. I didn't want to add more tension by asking my parents for money, she says. As soon as Hannah graduated and started working at a nonprofit, she began using part of her limited income to help with one-off expenses like a new computer. She now has a better-paying job in media, but over the past few years, family obligations have become an even larger percentage of her monthly budget. Since her dad's health forced him into partial retirement in 2018, bills have been piling up. Hannah sends spending money to her siblings, two of whom are still in college, and pays for part of her mother's tuition in a master's program. The expense that stresses her out the most, though, is the credit cards. There was a significant period during which my mom stopped working in order to care for the four of us, and she used credit cards to make up for the shortfall, she says. The interest penalty is really high, so paying that off has become my main priority. Hannah is hoping to save for a down payment on a home of her own, after her family's credit cards are paid off, after her mom gets her master's, after her siblings graduate and find jobs. The obligation to help relatives as much and as soon as possible can taint our relationship with them. An African-American professor I know says she doesn't mind providing financial assistance to her mother, but she does feel uneasy about the way it's changed their dynamic. I don't go shopping with her anymore because I know she'll ask me to pay for things, she says. She also thinks twice before sharing success stories with her family. I once won an award for $10,000, and my mom's reaction was, "How much are you going to give me?" There is definitely stress associated with the expectation that you'll be able to provide, explains Angela Neal Barnett, PhD, a psychological sciences professor at Kent State University who runs a program called Sisters Offering Support, or SOS, which facilitates meetups for Black professional women who may be experiencing anxiety. Many grew up as the golden child, so their family looks to them to take care of everything. Even in childhood and adolescence, many Black women were placed in a caregiving role. Once they get into the workforce, especially if they have the fancy job like attorney or doctor, it's expected that they will step up. If a person dies, you're to pay for the funeral. If someone gets in trouble, you're to pay bail. Extended family members see you as the bank. I work with SOS participants to help them set a budget with a line item for requests from relatives, if that's what they want, says Neal Barnett, author of Soothe Your Nerves, The Black Woman's Guide to Understanding and Overcoming Anxiety, Panic, and Fear. Sometimes the allocations are for the entire family. Some are broken out by person. Either way, she stresses the importance of staying within budget, even if the requests keep coming. We help people realize that saying no to a loved one does not make you a bad person. The main lesson? Pay yourself first. That can be hard to internalize, though. It was my therapist who helped me recognize something that's been stoking my financial anxiety. No one in my immediate family has gained a foothold in the middle class. As Valeria Jarrett, former advisor to President Obama, likes to say, you can't be what you can't see. I'm the first to attend college, let alone law school, and I have no role models showing me how I'm supposed to do everything I want to do, as well as everything that's expected of me. In many ways, I am the role model. Education is supposed to be our ticket, yet even here, Black women are stuck in a hole. The 2019 report, Deeper in Debt, Women and Student Loans, published by the American Association of University Women, or AAUW, found that Black women amass an average debt load of $30,366 by college graduation, compared with $21,993 for white women and $19,486 for white men. The same AAUW paper noted that after graduation, Black women struggle the most with repayment. 57% reported being unable to afford all essential expenses while dealing with student loans. According to a recent report from the liberal think tank Demos, the typical white male borrower has paid off 44% of his loan balance 12 years after beginning college, while the typical Black female borrower has seen her student loan balance grow by an additional 13% within the same period. 45% of Black female borrowers who started college in 2003 defaulted on a loan within 12 years, compared with only 20% of white female borrowers. The report noted the double bind faced by Black people. As we have slowly made progress opening the college gates over the past four decades, Black students are far more likely to borrow than white students and borrow in higher amounts. Students of color are contending with an increasingly expensive higher education system against the backdrop of centuries in which Black and brown people have been intentionally shut out of the ability to build wealth and pass it along to future generations. In other words, many students are not just borrowing against their future, but borrowing because of the past. Those loans can feel like shackles. According to the Duke and Insight researchers, the median wealth of a single Black woman in her 20s with a bachelor's degree is $11,000, meaning that her debts are $11,000 more than her assets and savings. For married Black women in their 30s with a bachelor's, it's $20,500. In contrast, a married white woman in her 30s with the same degree has a median wealth of $97,000. Even more shocking, single white women without a college degree have $3,000 more in median wealth than single Black women with a bachelor's degree. Then there's the crushing fact that black women are, as a rule, underpaid. We typically earn only 68 cents for every dollar paid to a white man, while white women earn 79 cents. And according to the 2018 Women in the Workplace survey conducted by McKinsey & Company, for every 100 men promoted to manager, only 60 black women are promoted. Black women account for less than 1% of partners at law firms, according to the National Association for Law Placement. On top of this, many black female employees are forced into the de facto role of diversity ambassador, which involves extra work to make our offices less hostile for other black employees, often for zero additional compensation, overtime, or bonus. Black workers are having to navigate environments where companies say they want more diversity but aren't putting resources or support into achieving that, explains Adia Wingfield, PhD, a professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. Wingfield's book, Flatlining: Race, Work, and Healthcare in the New Economy, explores how the healthcare industry in particular relies heavily on black employees to do the extra labor required to make their organizations and services more accessible to communities of color. Organizations are engaging in what I call racial outsourcing, she says. They leave the actual work of creating diversity to the black professionals and rely on those employees to make workplaces more welcoming and supportive for people of color. Black women are often caught in a catch-22 because they want to be supportive of colleagues of color, but at the same time, the extra support work isn't usually compensated. Many of the women Wingfield interviewed said they were aware their employers were taking advantage of their willingness to be helpful. Danielle, a friend of a friend, was working as a litigation associate at a New Jersey law firm when she was asked to serve on a task force to create a diversity website and publication for the firm. Although she was honored to be part of the project, when you work at a law firm where there's such an emphasis on billable hours, diversity work distracts from the billable tasks. Yet that's how the firm evaluates associates. Almost everyone asked to serve on the task force was a minority. Danielle didn't feel that she could say no. It would not have been looked well upon if I had declined to participate. The project involves significant time and intellectual labor, none of which she feels was factored into her raises or annual bonuses. Even when our companies don't overtly put that kind of pressure on us, we put it on ourselves. Last summer, when I realized that one of my firm's interns was a black student who had just finished his first year at Howard University School of Law, I immediately decided to take him under my wing. As the only black attorney in my department, I felt responsible for making sure he succeeded at the internship, introducing him to other potential mentors and connecting him with resources. After he expressed concern about his chances of landing a corporate law firm position for the following summer, I sprang into action, setting up informational interviews with partners and senior in-house counsel who'd be in a position to leverage their network on his behalf. Over the next 8 weeks, I took him out for countless coffees and almost daily lunches. We even went to a few legal galas. This was satisfying work that I wanted to do. One of my mantras is that it's okay to be the first, but it's not okay to be the last. But in hindsight, I recognize that some of that time could have been better spent on projects that might lead to a promotion, and in turn a higher salary and a faster payoff of my law school debt. It's frustrating that this extra labor is something most of my white counterparts don't have to think about doing or feel guilty about not doing. Every time I go to a professional conference, there's a panel on wealth building, and the advice is usually something like, invest in venture capital. When I asked Ann Price for her opinion on the best way forward, she said the conversation needs to shift from personal responsibility to more systemic fixes. The bootstrap narrative, in which we tell people that hard work is the best path to success, diverts us from what really landed us in this position and puts the onus on the individual to haul herself out of it, she says. But black women are already doing everything this country has told them is important to build a good and dignified life. What we need to do is change the system. That would mean new sweeping policies like erasing student loans or subsidizing real estate down payments and closing costs for people in neighborhoods historically discriminated against by lenders. It's encouraging that presidential candidates are already talking about these ideas. In the meantime, while I'm doing everything I can to increase my net worth, I'm also trying to change the way I evaluate my self-worth. Not long ago, I told my therapist about a recurring nightmare of struggling to climb to the top of a mountain, only to have a large shoe appear and kick me to the bottom. I didn't need a mental health professional to explain that this represents my fear of falling back into the poverty of my childhood, but I did require her help in dealing with the near constant concern it's been causing me lately. She encouraged me to stop blaming myself for what I haven't accomplished and focus instead on what I have. She also gave me a few useful tips. I now write down small achievements, e.g. hitting my savings goals for the month or paying off a credit card balance, and refer to them when I get discouraged. I try to remind myself that I can ask for help from a boss or a friend or a financial planner. And to find my own inspiring role models, I'm developing relationships with older Black women attorneys who share how they've made it to the top and how they've managed their disillusionment with the system. All very helpful, right? And it cost me only $400, the out-of-pocket price of a month's worth of counseling. Our next article by Robin Morantz Hennig is titled, The Ultimate Guide to Dealing with Menopause. When I was 48, I joined a new book club. At my first meeting, talk turned to an ex-member who'd been having a hard time with hot flashes. One evening, the women said things got especially bad for her. She shifted uncomfortably all through the book talk until finally she had to peel off her sweater for relief. When that wasn't enough, she tore off her blouse. When that wasn't enough, off came her tank top too, until there she sat red-faced and dripping in just her bra. Back then, the prospect of hot flashes terrified me. My mother's had been ferocious. If you haven't yet reached menopause, you might be terrified too, and not just by the idea of turning into the incredible flaming woman, stripped to her skivvies in someone else's living room. There are the hot flashes, the night sweats, the brain fog, the mood swings, the free-range rage, the bloating, the weight gain. And on top of those miseries is the loss they're supposed to portend, of sexiness, of fertility, of the best and juiciest part of your life, of femininity, of, if you take it far enough, your very womanness. You will become shriveled and uninteresting, the story goes, a dried up, barren husk of your former self, an old hag that no one lusts after anymore, and then you'll die. Here's the truth. You probably will sweat the physical stuff, and possibly the mood stuff, maybe a lot, perhaps a ton. You will likely, sometimes astonishingly, encounter bodily changes no one ever told you about. You might be frustrated and, yes, enraged by modern medicine's incomplete understanding of what is happening to you and by the cultural sexism that underlies that failure. But you may also make a significant discovery, something grand and important. You might even call it the discovery of a lifetime, that menopause, far from being the tragic end of the best part of a woman's existence, can actually be a threshold, a gateway, the passage to the you you've been waiting your whole life to become. Beginning with the first period at about age 12, to be female is to experience a decades-long cycle in which two powerful sex hormones, estrogen and progesterone, rise and fall, triggering the rhythms of menstruation. Estrogen, secreted by the ovaries as an egg matures, reaches its highest level during week 2 of a typical 4-week cycle. Progesterone, secreted after the egg follicle ruptures during ovulation, peaks between weeks 3 and 4. These two hormones are primarily responsible for getting a woman's body ready month after month to achieve and maintain a pregnancy. As the ovaries age in the 4 to 10 year lead up to menopause, known as perimenopause, which usually begins in the mid to late 40s, they don't reliably release an egg every month. And whenever a cycle takes place without ovulation, there's no empty egg follicle and no progesterone is produced. So that month, there's an imbalance. Too much estrogen, too little progesterone, and maybe the same is true 2 months later when again there's no ovulation, and a month or two after that. It can all lead to roiling hormonal swings that are a lot like puberty, except worse, because these inner storms happen while you're up to your eyeballs in the trappings of responsible adulthood. My perimenopausal patients are in the middle of very busy lives, says Joanne Pinkerton, MD, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Virginia and executive director emeritus of the North American Menopause Society, or NAMS. They're juggling their jobs and might be at the height of their careers or trying to reboot after being downsized or stressing over ageism in the workplace. Their kids, who might be hormonally charged teens themselves. Their aging parents with their increasing care needs. Their other health issues, which could include chronic conditions like hypertension, arthritis, and diabetes. And their love lives, which could be affected by all manner of factors, from divorce to romantic malaise to partners facing health issues of their own. All of these make the process of perimenopause much more difficult even than puberty was, Pinkerton says. Yet when it comes to navigating that process, women are, to a stunning degree, left to their own devices. Every girl gets the period talk, but almost no woman gets to talk about what's happening on the other end, says Stephanie S. Fabian, MD, medical director of NAMS and director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Women's Health. That's really a shame, and as a result, we have women coming to the clinic in a panic. They can't sleep, they're having heart palpitations, they're forgetting things, their hair is thinning, they're anxious, and they literally think they're dying when in fact they're just in perimenopause. If there was such a thing as the menopause talk, it would make sense for doctors to initiate it. But by and large, medical training doesn't equip them to do so. In a 2019 study in which researchers surveyed 177 residents in family medicine, internal medicine, and OBGYN, 20% received zero menopause lectures during their residency. Less than 7% said they felt prepared to manage the care of women in the various stages of menopause. The knowledge gap reflected in those numbers may explain why, in another survey, only 7% of midlife women with urogenital changes like vaginal dryness, pain during sex, urinary incontinence, said they had doctors who broached the subject of such changes with them. Instead, many women complain of doctors who minimize their concerns with essentially a pat on the head and a shrug of the shoulders and a reminder that menopause is just part of life. You could argue that this attitude represents progress. In her book, The Slow Moon Climbs, The Science, History, and Meaning of Menopause, Susan Mattern, a professor of history at the University of Georgia, notes that the author of the first American textbook on menopause from 1897 compared its effects to epilepsy, hysterical attacks, and the paroxysms of malaria. Thus began a trend of pathologizing a natural phenomenon experienced by half the human population. With the advent of hormone therapy, pioneered in the 1930s, first available in the U.S. in 1942, the trend became the rule. In the 1950s, a decade that loved its gender norms, the femininity fearmongers joined in, beating the drum of diminished sexuality and youthfulness. And in 1966, a Brooklyn gynecologist named Robert Wilson published a runaway bestseller, Feminine Forever, whose sexist attitudes linger today. Wilson was the Pied Piper of plying menopausal women with estrogen for the rest of their lives. With estrogen, he promised, they could look forward to eternal youth and attractiveness and menstruation. On Wilson's plan, women could expect to have 5 to 7 periods per year indefinitely. Without estrogen, they were fated to live as sexual neuters, suffering from a serious, painful, and often crippling disease that made long life an unnatural burden. Wilson wasn't speaking metaphorically when he said menopause could and should be cured. We surely don't want to go back to that kind of thinking, but as we make our way through perimenopause and menopause, we deserve to be able to function in our lives and in the world, comfortably and with dignity. That menopause isn't something to be cured shouldn't mean our only option is to grin and bear it, or gin and tonic and bear it while standing in front of an open freezer fanning ourselves. We aren't asked to do so with menstrual cramps or childbirth, other natural processes. Men aren't asked to do so with erectile dysfunction. ED, by the way, is the male equivalent of hot flashes in the sense that each is the most problematic symptom of the decline of a signature hormone. Yet as Amy M. Miller, PhD, president and CEO of the Society for Women's Health Research, notes with some frustration, at this point, treating ED is so commonplace it can be done with generic drugs. In the pecking order of American society, men still outrank women, and menopausal women often seem hardly to rank at all. Not just in the media or in Hollywood or on Tinder, but in all the places where we tend to become invisible as we age. And in biomedical research, which for years has left midlife women in the lurch. Happily, that's changing. Though you're still likely to kill a conversation by making mention of your hot flashes, you may not be embarrassed, but other people will be on your behalf, the menopausal transition is coming out of the shadows. Someday we may look back on 2019 as the year Darcy Stank invented a new publishing category, the menopause tell-all, with her flash count diary, Menopause and the Vindication of Natural Life. Certainly it should go down in history as the year the Emmy-nominated dramedy Fleabag featured Kristen Scott Thomas soliloquizing majestically about the menopause, the fucking menopause. More on this later. And let's not forget that in the UK, the University of Leicester has adopted an official, first-of-its-kind menopause policy designed to normalize the experience, inviting the women and men of its faculty and staff to monthly menopause cafes, and exhorting them simply to speak the word menopause 3 times daily. Want to try this yourself? You might start on October 18th, the World Menopause Day. As more women assume leadership roles in science and medicine, we're also seeing new data about what happens in our 40s and 50s, and using more dignified terminology to discuss it. In 2014, for instance, the condition crushingly known as vaginal atrophy was renamed genitourinary syndrome of menopause. One major source of this data is the Study of Women Across the Nation, or SWAN, now in its 23rd year. SWAN's origin story is instructive. Back in the 1990s, Sherry Sherman, an endocrinologist with the National Institute on Aging, then in her 40s, suspected a serious lack of scientific knowledge about midlife women. She was determined to do something about it, says Susan Johnson, an emerita professor of OBGYN and epidemiology at the University of Iowa and SWAN's current study chair. So Sherman organized a conference at the National Institutes of Health to gather what was understood about menopause at the time. It confirmed that the pool of knowledge was shallow indeed, at which point Sherman went out and secured funding to sponsor a network of 7 clinical sites to start collecting data from thousands of women then aged 42 to 52. The study has generated a slew of reports, close to 500 journal articles to date, that reveal menopause to be normal, natural, sometimes difficult, but eminently survivable. It was SWAN that really focused new attention on perimenopause, helping establish it as a pivotal point when a woman's lifestyle choices can have a profound effect on her future health. Sherman died in 2014, but SWAN, her legacy, is potent proof of what scientific research can achieve when the people asking and answering the questions are women, as 7 of SWAN's 10 principal investigators are. That same lesson was borne out by a groundbreaking 2016 study from Johns Hopkins, the work of 2 female Hopkins OBGYNs, Wen Shin, MD, and Mindy Christensen, MD, who a few years earlier had surveyed hundreds of OBGYN residents across the U.S. to see whether they'd had adequate instruction on menopause, and finding that they hadn't, devised a 2-year menopause medicine curriculum to see if it made a difference. Did it ever? Before the curriculum, 76% of residents felt barely comfortable managing the care of menopause patients. 8.4% felt not at all comfortable. After the curriculum, the cohort of comfortable, very comfortable had swelled to 86%. Wen and Christensen are now menopause education evangelists. They put their lectures on CDs that they send free to other OBGYN programs, and Wen has even developed an app to answer practitioners' treatment questions. NAMS is similarly invested in boosting practitioner know-how by offering a certification program in menopausal health. Any licensed healthcare provider, physician, nurse, naturopath, physician's assistant, pharmacist, social worker, psychologist, can sit in for the exam, which consists of 100 multiple choice questions that test knowledge on everything from hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis to bone mineral density tests, to the use of isoflavones and herbs as alternative therapies. Currently, 1,131 practitioners are certified. The NAMS website, menopause.org, has a handy tool to help you find one near you. I could have benefited from seeing such a practitioner myself. Like many women, I was surprised to find that as my ovaries wound down, periods aggressively ramped up. I bled like crazy, heavily, unpredictably, sometimes in clots so thick it felt like a vampire cleanse. I went to business meetings, dinners, movies, massively pre-padded. The only thing that staunched the flow was going back on the birth control pill in my late 40s, a treatment not without risks, but risks I was willing to take. I never did get the hot flashes that plagued my mother. It turns out that your menopause doesn't necessarily mimic your mother's, nor does it have any obvious connection to our own reproductive history, whether you had easy pregnancies, tough ones, or none at all. Scientists do know that women who've ever suffered a major depressive episode have a 59% greater chance of experiencing another one in perimenopause. They've also found suggestive links between childhood trauma and the severity of menopause symptoms, and there are hints that women who had PMS will experience more mood issues. But experts are still testing out all these relationships, which are multi-layered and complex. In my early 50s, I went off the pill to see if things had settled down. They had. Eventually, after a year without bleeding, I was diagnosed as having gone through menopause. I was done, and that was a relief. I was glad to say goodbye to periods, glad to be liberated from the emergency fortifications I'd grown used to carting around, glad to no longer be ruled by a cycle and instead be able to focus on myself and my own shifting needs. A lot of work goes into being a woman of childbearing age. Mine was finished. And I had it relatively easy. My husband had a vasectomy when we were in our 30s, so I'd already enjoyed years of not needing to give one single thought to birth control. Plus, I'd never faced the risks that fertility brings for women and girls in so many parts of the world. The UN Population Fund, or UNFPA, has reported that every 2 minutes a woman dies from pregnancy or childbirth-related causes. Depending on where you live, menstruation-based discrimination can lead to shunning, harassment, lost school days, lost wages, and according to UNFPA, transactional sex to pay for menstrual supplies. For me, a lucky middle-class American, getting to menopause was a new kind of freedom. For other women, it is a salvation. I did wonder, though, what's the point of menopause in evolutionary terms? What's the advantage of a trait that makes reproduction impossible? In almost every other animal species, not counting killer whales, short-finned pilot whales, belugas, and narwhals, females can bear young until nearly their dying day, yet women lose that ability and then go on to live another third of their life. Paleoanthropologists have suggested that, far from being merely an aberration among humans, menopause is what made us human. The so-called grandmother hypothesis, which gained traction in the 1990s thanks to field data gathered by anthropologist Kristen Hawkes of the University of Utah, posits that menopause gave our forebears the chance to evolve some of our most salient beneficial traits. As the theory goes, early humans lived in multi-generational kinship groups, and the postmenopausal women in these groups, lacking young children of their own, played a critical role in aiding the survival of their offspring's children, who, living to adulthood, were able to procreate and pass on their grandmother's longevity genes. This in turn allowed for the evolution of more complex brains and the development of cooperation and sociability. Nicely done, cave ladies. Scientists may still be years away from obliterating hot flashes. Even female scientists with a lot at stake personally. Even rockstar female scientists who vacationed together in California wine country, as the Mayo Clinic's Stephanie Fabian recently did with incoming NAMS president and hot flash specialist Rebecca Thurston, and cognition authority Pauline Mackay. Women's health experts, they're just like us. But while we can't yet put a stop to all internal conflagrations, we can redefine what it means to have them. Because the truth is, menopause is not an end, it's a beginning. A searing initiation, a crucible in which a more essential version of ourselves is forged. We go through the fire and come out refined, able, often for the first time ever, to focus on the things we care about most. And yes, we can focus. Mackay says the brain fog related to the loss of estrogen and perimenopause dissipates postmenopause, possibly because in a scenario researchers are at this very minute exploring, The brain develops its own ingenious neurological workarounds. What do some of our formidable, fearless leaders have in common? They're women who came to the fullness of their powers on the other side of menopause. These include Nancy Pelosi, Elizabeth Warren, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Think of Christine Lagarde, Patti Smith, Ruth E. Carter, Sister Helen Prejean, all forces to be reckoned with as younger women, but none of them as deeply visionary, as thoroughly glorious as when they got to the other side. And then there's Belinda Frears, that Kristen Scott Thomas character in Fleabag, a successful businesswoman who, in one episode, has a martini at a bar with the show's obviously smitten 33-year-old female protagonist. At 58, Belinda is every inch her own awesome dame, knowing, confident, worldly, humane, and damn sexy, and she has wisdom to share. Being a woman, Belinda says, is about pain. Women are born to pain, what with the cramps, the aching breasts, the childbirth, and so forth. And then, just when you feel you are making peace with it all, what happens? The menopause comes. The fucking menopause comes. And it is the most wonderful fucking thing in the world. Yes, your entire pelvic floor crumbles, and you get fucking hot, and no one cares, but then you're free. No longer a slave, no longer a machine with parts, you're just a person. In business. It's horrendous, but then it's magnificent. Something to look forward to. Wouldn't you raise a glass to that? So what happens when you flash? Starting in perimenopause, your internal thermostat goes on the fritz. The part of your brain responsible for sensing and controlling body heat overreacts to even slight changes in core body temperature. This is likely due in part to estrogen withdrawal, Thurston says, but could also be due to extreme estrogen fluctuations. The neurotransmitters norepinephrine and serotonin play a role, as do special neurons in the hypothalamus. But more research is required to know exactly how they factor in. Most women report noticing triggers that make them flash, for example, spicy food, stress, or red wine. However, Thurston and her team haven't been able to manipulate these possible culprits to induce hot flashes in the lab. We've tried to warm women up with special heating pads, stress them out by asking them to, say, perform difficult math tasks, but they're just as likely to flash while sitting calmly. Thurston would know. She monitors participants' brain, heart, and blood vessels so she can measure when they're flashing, even when they don't realize they are. Neurons in the brain are activated, and the hypothalamus sends out the signal that the body needs to cool down. In response, you experience vasodilation, widening of your veins, arteries, and capillaries to increase blood flow and dissipate heat, as well as the cursed sweating. You may be oversensitive to drops in body temperature, too, which is why clamminess, shivering, and chills often follow hot flashes. The hot flash can last from 1 to 15 minutes, usually closer to 5, before your body temperature returns to the comfortable range. The process can continue for 7 to 9 years. That's the mean duration, although a third of women flash for longer. It's not uncommon to have hot flashes into your 70s or beyond. Scientists are working on finding a reliable predictor of when they will stop. The problem with not fully understanding how and why flashes happen is that it limits the development of new treatments. Hormone therapy can be very effective, but it's not the best option for every woman, and other treatments come with side effects and caveats too. But some explosive new findings could change everything. Thanks to Thurston and other scientists, it's now believed that hot flashes may be associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease, the number one killer of women, says Stephanie Fabian of NAMS. Adds Thurston, we've seen that women with more and more frequent hot flashes, upward of 4 in a day, often have signs of underlying vascular dysfunction that can put them at risk for future cardiovascular issues. We don't think hot flashes cause the dysfunction, they just help identify women who have it. Showing the connection isn't meant to scare women, says Fabian. On the contrary, it could be the thing that saves them. By directing public interest and all-important research dollars into this hot-button menopausal symptom. Do this in your 40s and thank yourself in your 60s. You'll never drop dead of a hot flash, but flashes and other perimenopausal symptoms are red flags telling you it's time to get serious about your health, says Tara Allman, MD, a board-certified gynecologist in New York City. The great news is that you already know how. Just follow the advice your doctor has been repeating for years. They give you all this information about healthy habits in your 20s or 30s, but women that age often shrug it off. Says Siobhan Harlow, PhD, a professor of epidemiology and global public health at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Then you hit midlife and your body stops bouncing back the way it used to. Is it ironic that we finally have to take healthy living seriously just when so many of us are feeling too stressed and sluggish to do so? Yes, but think of these lifestyle changes as a gift to your fabulous future self. Number one, practice good sleep hygiene. It seems like a cruel joke to suggest that women plagued by night sweats and insomnia need to sleep better, but doing so is vital to your well-being now and forever. When you're rested, you're more likely to make healthier food choices and to exercise, be in a better mood, and have sharper cognition. So make sleep hygiene your religion. Thou shalt not drink alcohol after dinner or binge on Netflix until 1 a.m. And if the goddess of Z still forsakes you, speak to a psychologist about insomnia or a sleep specialist about apnea. Number two, lower your stress. It can take a serious toll on your physical and mental health. Research shows benefits from regular exercise and meditation, but also consider talking to a therapist, especially if you're prone to depression, which can put you at greater risk of having a depressive episode in perimenopause. And don't forget your friends. Social interaction is a known mood booster. Number three, get heart smart. Talk to your doc about cardiovascular risk factors like high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, and diabetes. Eat healthy, more plants, whole grains, poultry, and fish, less saturated fat, sodium, red meat, and processed foods, and commit to aerobic workouts at least 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity activity. If you've been prescribed heart meds, take them, and note that as frequent hot flashes during menopause may be associated with increased cardiovascular disease risk, all of this advice is crucial for flashers. Number four, rebuild strong bones. A decrease in estrogen can accelerate the natural loss of bone. Make sure you're getting enough vitamin D, doing weight-bearing exercises like running, jumping rope, and squat jumps. They help build bone in addition to growing muscle. And practicing yoga, which can help reinforce bones while improving balance. Number five, maintain a healthy weight. With age, we lose muscle mass and our metabolism slows, both of which can lead to weight gain. On average, midlife women gain 1.5 pounds per year, which often shows up in the midsection as a result of decreasing estrogen levels. Fat in the abdominal area can increase the risk of serious conditions, including diabetes, breast cancer, and cardiovascular disease. Following all the above advice will help ward off weight gain, as will lifting weights to build calorie-burning muscle. Number six, quit smoking. It makes every other health issue worse. Our next article by Gretchen Rubin is titled, Making a Big Move, Here's How to Make a New City Feel Like Home. A few weeks ago, we posed the following question to readers on Facebook and Instagram. Are you in the midst of making a big change? If so, what is causing you the most anxiety and why? From the hundreds of responses we received, two seismic shifts seem to be exceedingly common. People considering a major career change, which I addressed in my last column, or a life-altering move. I heard from those leaving small, cramped apartments in major cities for more spacious houses in the suburbs, couples who are buying their first home or selling their beloved family home, and adventure lovers who were moving across the country or even across the world. For example, one woman was returning to the U.S. after spending nearly a decade abroad. Not to mention those who were relocating to be closer to or farther from friends and family. In many ways, that's to be expected. Studies have shown that natural disasters and other traumatic events can spur people to make big changes as a result of significant shifts in how we think and relate to the world. And the COVID-19 pandemic has been no exception. It's disrupted nearly every aspect of our existence, which, yes, has caused tremendous hardship and suffering, but it's also offered a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to reassess our values and lifestyles, to leave jobs that no longer feel fulfilling, to move on from relationships that have run their course, and to escape cities that suddenly feel stressful and overwhelming. In fact, the U.S. Postal Service reported that it processed nearly 36 million change of address requests last year, while home sales in 2020 hit the highest level since 2006, according to the National Association of Realtors. That said, even the easiest move can be incredibly challenging, and perhaps even more so when we've already been dealing with a lot of uncertainty, anxiety, and change. So with that in mind, I'll address two of the most common moving-related concerns we received from readers. I'm moving to a new city, and I'm having trouble letting go and embracing something new. Ileana Bloom from Oakland, California. First things first, it's perfectly normal to feel pangs of loss as you prepare to leave the city that you love. In the weeks leading up to your move, jot down all the restaurants, landmarks, museums, and other local attractions that have been on your bucket list for a long time, and make a plan to actually do them. Equally important, carve out some time for all the people and places that made your home feel like, well, home. Have one last meal at your go-to restaurant. Spend an afternoon browsing the shelves at your beloved indie bookstore. Pick up some fresh produce at your favorite farmer's market. Host a farewell picnic in your local park. Enjoy a nightcap at your neighborhood hangout and order dinner from your tried-and-true takeout place. At the same time, to help you look forward to your big leap, make an explore list including everything you want to do in your new city. Think parks and museums you want to stop by, restaurants and bars you want to try, nearby neighborhoods or towns you want to visit, hikes or day trips you want to go on, shops you want to wander around, and just about anything else that seems interesting to you. Additionally, consider adding the names, phone numbers, and email addresses of people you're hoping to connect with once you've settled in. Whether that's an old acquaintance who lives in your new city, people that friends have urged you to meet, important work contacts and colleagues, or anyone else who might become part of your new life. Finally, to make the transition less taxing, you should also take note of the essential places and services that'll make your life easier, including the closest 24-hour drugstore, hardware store, library, post office, office supply store, and grocery store. If you already have the Google Maps app downloaded on your phone, you can even save these spots as starred places so you can easily locate them. As you slowly tackle that list, you'll begin to feel more settled in. Plus, as you meet new people, you'll have a great conversation starter. Simply ask them to share their top picks for what to eat, see, and do in your new city. In my experience, people love to talk about their favorite hidden gems and must-do activities. We moved recently, and I have anxiety about making friends here, especially during the ongoing pandemic. Elise Zawicki from Urbana, Illinois. You're very wise to realize that making friends is a very important part of making your move happier. For decades, behavioral scientists have spent a lot of time studying what does and doesn't make us happy, and if there is one point in which virtually every piece of research agrees, it's this. Solid social ties are one of the strongest, most consistent keys to happiness. We need close relationships with people who we can confide in, who make us feel like we belong, and who we can rely on for support. In fact, one Harvard study, which followed the same group of men for more than 80 years, found that having strong personal connections with other people was most directly correlated to overall happiness, better health, and more contentment. That's especially true if you surround yourself with happy people. A longitudinal analysis published in the BMJ found that a person is 15% more likely to be happy if a friend is happy, and that a person's happiness can also influence and be influenced by their friends' friends and even friends' friends' friends. What's more, close bonds not only benefit our mental health, but also our physical health. Research has shown that a lack of social connection carries health risks comparable to that of smoking, and is about twice as dangerous to our health as obesity. Now here's the thing, making friends can feel incredibly daunting, especially as you get older. So here are a few pieces of friendly advice. Phone a friend. Just because a city is new to you doesn't mean you're starting with an entirely blank slate. Lean on your existing social networks, friends, family members, former coworkers, and ask them to connect you with people they know who live in your new city. Additionally, consider if there is anyone who you could reconnect with, like a friend from college or even high school, a teammate from your post-college recreational sports league, or an acquaintance from your younger years. Put yourself out there. Making friends takes effort, so don't be afraid to be bold. If someone invites you to something, say yes, no matter what. Challenge yourself to randomly swing by a coworker's desk and ask them to grab a cup of coffee. Try chatting with parents waiting in the school pickup line. Strike up conversation with neighbors who are walking their dog. Sit at your neighborhood coffee shop for a couple of hours without your phone. Join a group. Being part of a group where you have common interests and gather regularly is one of the easiest ways to make new connections and friendships. And these days, there's something for just about everyone. You could take a cooking class or a photography course, participate in a creative writer's workshop, sign up for a running club or intramural sports league, become part of a nearby congregation, volunteer at a local shelter or food bank, or join your neighborhood book club. You could even browse Meetup, an online platform that helps bring together people with common interests, whether that's craft, cocktails, Bravo TV shows, or Twilight bike rides. Plus, one advantage to making friends through a group is that you can build friendships with several people at once. So if you've always wanted to take a yoga class, now is a great time. You'll get the benefits of yoga, and you also might make some terrific new friends. Use a friend-finding app. Chances are you already use an app to order takeout, call a car, and manage your to-do list. So why not use one to make new friends, too? Similar to its popular dating app, Bumble BFF asks you to create a profile, complete with photos and a quick bio, then allows you to swipe right or left on people who you might want to connect with. If you're a mom or mom-to-be, Peanut will connect you with other local moms or moms-to-be who have similar interests and similar age children. So you can get parenting advice, set up play dates for your little ones, and connect with someone navigating the same, sometimes messy, emotional terrain. While the pandemic and the accompanying stay-at-home orders and social distancing have inevitably made this process harder, one upside to our downtime is that there are even more ways to connect virtually with both new and old friends. Plus, it should become easier again as you begin to move out into the world a bit more. Until then, do your best and also cut yourself some slack if the process takes longer than it otherwise would. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.